Hello everyone, I'm Mike Norris and welcome to My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the great landmarks in music history. I'd like to thank you very much for tuning in for this episode, and thanks to everyone who's tuned in for the previous two, particularly our previous episode on Radiohead's OK Computer. Ian Matthews, my special guest for that episode, and I have had some fantastic feedback from Radiohead fans, and I just hope that you got as much out of listening to the podcast as we did recording it. Radiohead are not a band that I've listened to much previously, but I really enjoyed the album. I really enjoyed my conversation with Ian, and I think the podcast came together really nice, and as I say, I hope that you all enjoyed it. Now, it's only episode 3, but already lots of people are getting in touch, and they're asking to appear on future episodes of the show, covering a wide range of albums. Now, today, for example, we're covering Led Zeppelin 2. Now, a classic rock album in every sense of the word, Led Zeppelin 2, like Revolver, like OK Computer, is always thrown about in these conversations, as is it one of the greatest albums of all time. But a lot of the messages and the requests that I'm receiving from listeners cover a fantastic range of albums, and I'm hoping that in the coming months we can visit all of those albums and we can have a good look into them, just like we have with Revolver, just like we have with OK Computer, and just like we are today with Led Zeppelin 2. September's been a really interesting month for me, actually. Not only all the fantastic feedback from the Radiohead podcast, but on the 1st of September I woke up to an email in my inbox inviting me to the screening of the new Beatles documentary, 8 Days a Week, The Touring Years. Before it came out on general release, they were doing 4 screenings across the country, one of which was in Liverpool, and I was invited to attend anyone that I wanted to go to. Unfortunately, I was unable to attend, which was absolutely gutting, but I'm definitely going to go and see the film now it's out on general release. It's getting so much buzz in the news, and Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr have been promoting it like crazy. I'd be daft not to see it, to be perfectly honest, but it's just a shame that I couldn't go to this very exclusive screening and check it out. I would recommend, if you're a Beatles fan, to go and see it. It's getting absolute rave reviews, and hopefully if I get to see it in the next month or so, I will talk about it on the podcast and just see what I thought of it. But it seems like it's a fascinating look at one of, if not the most successful band of all time in their touring years. So absolutely go and check it out if you get the chance. But on September 11th, I was in London for Radio 2's Festival in a Day at Hyde Park. Now, I was there last year. Rod Stewart headlined last year, but I'd gone down mainly to see The Cause, who were playing for the first time in 10 years as a band, and it was absolutely fantastic. And I'd said to my wife that, obviously, the show had been fantastic, but it was the vibe at Hyde Park and how Radio 2 set out that festival that would make me go back, depending on the lineup. And this year's lineup was possibly the strongest that they've ever had for Radio 2 at Hyde Park. Elton John headlined proceedings. Now, I've been lucky enough to see Elton John once. He's one of my all-time favourites. To see him a second time was something that I just never thought would happen. So it was great to be able to stand in Hyde Park and hear Elton John sing all these classics. I mean, if you ever get the chance to go and see Elton John, he's touring the UK a lot over the next year. If you can afford it, I would absolutely recommend it. Madness were directly below Elton John. I've seen Madness a few times. I actually danced with my wife to It Must Be Love at our wedding, and I absolutely love them. I always have. I think they're just a really fun, lively band, and everyone just gets out of their seats and just goes crazy at a Madness gig. And once again, they didn't disappoint. Madness were absolutely fantastic. For me, with the exception of those two, I would have to go for Gregory Porter as my act of the day. Gregory Porter, who I've seen on TV and always wanted to get a chance to go and see, was there. And his voice is absolutely phenomenal. And if you get the chance to see Gregory Porter, I could not recommend it more. He is absolutely phenomenal. A personal highlight for me had to be Craig Charles coming out and doing a little mini DJ set. Now, I know that he does do the odd show on Radio 2, and I think he's on Six Music as well, but I wasn't expecting to see him there, to be honest. He was doing voiceovers for the videos that were coming on before the acts. So when he came on, I was just over the moon. As I say, I love Red Dwarf. And he, because he's very much in a kind of a funk soul kind of vibe, he was playing some really great music for the 10 minutes that he was on. And he did this fantastic kind of mix of Uptown Funk by Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars and Living in America. And it just flowed so well. And it was just great to see him. Red Dwarf is actually, well, by the time this airs, Red Dwarf's new series will be on TV in the UK. So it was a great time to see him as well, because then it got me excited for Red Dwarf, which is probably my favourite TV show of all time. So if you get a chance to see any of those, and I include Craig Charles in that, if you ever see him doing a DJ set anywhere, absolutely go, because he was great. He was really good. He got cut off far too soon, though, I thought. He just got cut off really abruptly, but I guess that they were keeping time. So when I got back from Hyde Park, it was around the time that Meatloaf's new album was being released. Now, anyone who is on the Facebook page for My Classic Album will know my opinions on this, but Braver Than We Are is the latest Meatloaf album, and it's the first album since Bat Outta Hell 2, which has been completely written by Jim Steinman, who was a frequent collaborator with Meatloaf in the 70s and the 80s. Now, Bat Outta Hell 3, of course, came out about 10 years ago, but not all the songs were by Jim Steinman. There was a bit of disagreement about the name, and they came to a compromise. So Braver Than We Are, in some ways, is the legitimate Bat Outta Hell 3, which might sound like quite a strange comment to make, but I guess people who've heard the album or follow Meatloaf's career would kind of understand that a bit more. I've got to say that when I first heard the main single, I was quite shocked. His voice is very frail, and it sounded like he was kind of really struggling. And for someone who, regardless of what you think of Meatloaf, has had a phenomenal voice throughout his entire career, I was listening and I was kind of, wow, I didn't understand. I was really kind of taken aback. I'd read some things where people had said, you need to listen to the whole album from start to finish. And I kind of understood that with what was saying about My Classic Album and the idea of listening to an album as a package rather than just listening to like odd songs and tidbits from it. So on the day the album came out, I listened to Braver Than We Are from start to finish. And there's no doubt that Meatloaf's voice isn't what it was. As we say, we forget that he's 68 years old. He kind of almost seems untouchable sometimes, but I think his age is starting to catch up with him. And he is under some ill health, which he's discussed on his promotional tour of the UK. However, it is in some ways a really essential Meatloaf album, simply because it kind of finishes the story. I always felt that Bat Outta Hell was this album about kind of the excitement of youth and passion and drama. And that's what I loved about it so much. Bat Outta Hell 2 was kind of reflecting on that and looking back at an idea of sort of wasted youth and kind of what did I do with my childhood? And you're kind of in this kind of position where you think, well, you know, have I done the right things? That sort of thing. Braver Than We Are is almost the end of that cycle. And I used to say that about Bat Outta Hell 3, but it's even more true, Braver Than We Are. It's kind of looking back on your life, looking forward, this idea of mortality. If you look at the front cover of that album, it's Meatloaf, Jim Steinman, facing off the four horsemen of the apocalypse, all on motorcycles, and you think, that's a really good representation of what that album's about, and it's this idea of facing your own mortality. And I'm aware that a lot of the songs on the album Jim wrote previously, they've been for other projects or other artists, or even before Bat Outta Hell, but it's kind of a theme that's visited throughout the album, and you kind of really need to listen to it to get what I mean. What I also liked about it, which I'm sure some people won't like about it, is the fact that it really hints at previous works by both of them. So there's lyrics taken from 2 Out of 3 Ain't Bad on one of the songs, I think it's Souvenirs. There's another track where the turnaround Bright Eyes from Total Eclipse of the Heart is used. From what I can gather from what Meatloaf said, it's actually come from that song originally. The song that he's performing on the album was written well before Total Eclipse of the Heart. So they've decided to use it for both. And it's really cool to kind of hear this kind of salute to the past, because it feels like a last album. I could be wrong. It feels like a last Meatloaf album. And in that sense, after listening to him for so long and for people who've enjoyed him for nearly 40 years, surely, you know, it's a last opportunity to sit down and listen to a fantastic artist. And I've said before, the original Bat Outta Hell is my favourite album of all time. And hopefully we'll cover that one time on My Classic Album. So I kind of went from this shock at how Meatloaf's voice had changed to kind of appreciating the album for what it is. And it's an album I've listened to a couple of times since, and it's certainly worth a listen. If you're a Meatloaf fan, just listen to it with an open mind. I mean, if you hate it at the end, you hate it. But Meatloaf said that himself. You're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. So yeah, there's been quite a lot going on this month for me relating to music. And I've got a few gigs coming up in the next couple of months and a few more interviews to record for the podcast. So I'm a busy boy at the moment. Okay, so let's just get down to business. Led Zeppelin 2 is the topic of today's podcast. Andy Barkus will be here in just a little while to discuss the very album with me. But before he is, let's just have a look at all we need to know about Led Zeppelin 2.
Led Zeppelin 2.
Led Zeppelin 2 is the second studio album by rock icons Led Zeppelin. The album was released on the 22nd of October 1969 in the US, followed by a Halloween release for the UK. Atlantic Records handled the release of the album, which was produced by the band's guitarist Jimmy Page, who incorporated engineer Eddie Kramer into the project. The band famously chose not to release singles from their albums in the UK, but Whole Lotta Love finally entered the UK single charts in 1997 at number 21. Meanwhile, back in 1970, the track was released in the US against the band's wishes and reached number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100. The US release of the single sold over 1 million copies and reached gold certification on the 13th of April 1970. Whole Lotta Love and its signature riff have become a milestone in rock, but tracks including Ramble On and Heartbreaker also made it onto Led Zeppelin's best of compilation, Mothership, in 2007. Led Zeppelin 2 itself was a huge hit on both sides of the Atlantic, reaching number 1 on both the UK and US album charts. The album stayed on the UK album charts for a staggering 138 weeks and ended up going 4 times platinum in the UK. Meanwhile, in 1999, the RIAA registered 12 million copies of the album being sold in the US, making it 12-time platinum at that point. As well as being hailed as the blueprint for hard rock and heavy metal, Classic Rock magazine called Led Zeppelin 2 the 8th greatest rock album ever in 2006, while Guitarist magazine called the album the 3rd most influential guitar album of all time ever in 1994. So that's just the beginning of what you need to know about this fantastic album, Led Zeppelin 2. And I have here with me Andy Vargas, who chose the album to cover in this episode. Hi Andy, how's it going?
Good day, sir. It's all going good.
Awesome. So, as I've just alluded to there, and I said at the start, you picked this album for episode 3 of My Classic Album. Led Zeppelin have had like an absolutely phenomenal back catalogue full of classic albums. 1 to 4, particularly spring to mind for me, is kind of milestones. What is it about Led Zeppelin, and particularly this album, that made you go for Led Zeppelin 2?
The first thing is Whole Lotta Love, because when I was a kid, Top of the Pops, and there's people that are listening that won't even know what Top of the Pops is, which is so crazy, but like that was the theme to Top of the Pops, and you just can't forget something like that. Once I started looking back into music properly and I found out who it was, and when I was listening to like more rock music and stuff, I thought this was like on par with number one. Easy. I think it's a brilliant album.
It is a brilliant album. And I think it's sometimes it's underlooked in the way that 4 often receives a lot of plaudits as like the ultimate Led Zeppelin album. You've got tracks like When the Levee Breaks, Black Dog, and obviously Stairway to Heaven. And you're talking about 1 and obviously the classic tracks in 1. What is it about 2 particularly that stands out for you?
Well, like I said, Whole Lotta Love is probably the best song on there. Ramble On is also a brilliant song. I think the fact that this album, it seems to me like it's kind of being pushed to the side ever so slightly.
And I think a big part of that, and we'll go into this in more detail later, is all these issues of accusations of plagiarism, of kind of all these classic blues artists. And that is something we'll touch on possibly more when we're going through track by track on the songs. So you've talked a bit about Top of the Pops and hearing that kind of riff for the first time, and we will actually discuss that riff in great detail. Is that your like first memory of hearing like Led Zeppelin in general, or the album?
I think it is, yeah, I think it is. Like, Top of the Pops was always a big thing in my house. My parents were well into music. We would go on, like, car journeys and stuff, and I can remember which CDs, or tapes, or whatever it was back then that we had. It was brilliant.
And I think that's it. It's something about your child, isn't it? It's when you kind of hear music that... So for me, I've talked on the podcast before about how much I love Queen and Meatloaf, and these are the songs that my parents would play when we were on long car journeys or just chilling around the house. So part of it for you is that you were hearing like Whole Lotta Love and these other kind of classic rock staples.
Yeah.
It's an album that really wears its influences on its sleeve, but at the same time, it's a very influential album in itself, which is quite an interesting thing.
Yeah.
So we talked about 4, how 4 is almost kind of Led Zeppelin at their peak, this kind of creative package. 2 is almost the start of that, and we're seeing lots of seeds being planted. We're seeing things start to happen that would end up making Led Zeppelin kind of the ultimate hard rock band, not just for music fans, but for musicians and bands of the future who would look on them as a kind of a great influence. There is a really strong blues influence on this album, and we'll kind of go into that quite a bit. Do you have much of a kind of a experience of listening to the blues or any blues artists that you particularly enjoy, or is it just... you really like the sound that Led Zeppelin make when they're trying to replicate that?
Not only do I like the blues, but I like the way that they have their own interpretation of it. Just like the Stones did and bands like that. They all had their own thing, especially down south. The way Jimmy Page came across, the way he played some of his tracks, it just blows my mind. It does. Blows my mind.
And I mean, we've already started talking about Whole Lotta Love, and you've got the Lemon Song as well, and they're kind of reworked blues standards, if you like.
Yeah.
Do you think that that blues influence is integral to this album's success?
I don't know if it's integral. I know it was an integral part of making the album. I don't know whether it was its success. I don't know if that was already going because of the press catching up to them eventually. It's a hard one to answer, really. I do think it was integral to the album, but on the whole, it probably wasn't as integral as we think, because at the end of the day, they were a blues band who knew their stuff. Like, these had it down, ex-session musicians and whatnot.
We think of Led Zeppelin, we've got that benefit of hindsight to look back nearly 50 years and see how that band evolved, and that they're very much the start of hard rock and heavy metal to an extent, which we'll kind of get into. But I guess at the very beginning, there was the blues, and that's kind of what they played, and that's what they knew.
Yeah, that's it. I've seen interviews with people, like guitarists from famous bands, and it's before electric guitars, and it's when they first got their first amp, and they plugged it in, and they could turn it up, and it just blew their mind. But before that, you did have predominantly the blues played on guitar, and as good as it was, being now a bit more of a rocker than any other music, I think they were fantastic at it. They put their own spin on it, and they were one of the best in the world.
Absolutely. Now, the album came out in October 1969, so as I said, we're talking about 46 years ago when Led Zeppelin 2 came out. And 4 months later, Black Sabbath released their debut album. Some say that these two albums particularly or the birth of heavy metal.
I think I agree with that, yeah. Led Zeppelin probably were the first you could consider heavy metal with some of their songs. And then when you've got Black Sabbath coming along as well, and they're even heavier, using like dirtier sound effects and whatnot, I think that really was the start of hard rock.
Yeah, I think so. And I think this kind of, it's almost an equation, if you like, that if you take that dirty Sabbath sound, those the down-tuned guitars and the dark subject matter, Sabbath were really controversial at the time because of what they were singing about and what people decided that they were all about. And then you take that riff-based heavy sound that Zeppelin started to perfect on this album, and that's essentially heavy metal. That's essentially you banging the two together, and that's what it is. So I feel like they both have a really important part in the kind of the development of this, what is now like an absolutely, even to this day, a massive genre in music.
Oh yeah, it's monolithic now, heavy metal, and you've got, so if you go onto any music site and type in heavy metal, there's so many other things that come with it, like classic metal, new metal, rap metal. The list goes on.
It does kind of just branch off now. And I know I watched a documentary a few years ago called Metal Evolution. It was like a 12-part series where they literally did that, and they had this whole like family tree of metal in it. And it started with the blues and Zeppelin and Sabbath, and then it goes off in all these crazy directions to even like you say, new metal, death metal. Even I heard of a genre recently called pirate metal, which is essentially, there's a great band called Ailstorm that you should check out, who essentially, it's all heavy metal, but the subject matter is all about being pirates on ships and raping and pillaging and drinking. But it's crazy to think that all these crazy genres, even if you go to Japan at the minute and bands like Baby Metal, it all kind of starts from the same place. And a huge part of that is this album. And I think that's the crazy thing. You could listen to a song like Karate by Baby Metal and you would think, how could we link this back to Led Zeppelin? But it does. There's very much a defined kind of route that these take. What is it, do you think, about that sound that's just resonated so much for nearly 50 years now?
I think it's when they jammed on stage, they put across such a vibe with the people. Like, for instance, one of them could go off and start to solo, and then he could solo for 10 minutes and someone else could join in, and they would come back so tight and so well. they just kind of perfected it in a way. They were like the original rockers, if you like, with the kind of, not just the music, but with the clothing they wore and things like that, what they sang about.
Yeah.
Like, they were they're the grandfathers of rock, really.
And I think that's what's cool, that as you were saying, that there's so much into the subject matter or how songs are set out or even the image of a band that really kind of comes from Led Zeppelin and what was happening around this time. You got bands like Aerosmith, Guns N' Roses, Iron Maiden, who were directly influenced by Led Zeppelin. You've got guitarists like Steve Vai or Eddie Van Halen, who look at Jimmy Page particularly as a huge influence. And I think, and I'll talk about this more when we talk about Heartbreaker, I think you can really, really hear what it is about Jimmy Page that influences Eddie Van Halen when you listen to the two.
But I would say that they, in their own right, are also mega guitarists. But he inspired them.
Yeah.
Like, and he's an amazing guitarist too. Imagine the three together in a room of three. It'd be insane.
Yeah, it's just that evolution, isn't it? That kind of, there's things that guitarists do now that we wouldn't even have dreamed about in the late 60s and the early 70s, but it's just kind of the way that music evolves, as we've been talking about the whole time. How important is Jimmy Page's contribution to the album in that sense?
I think Jimmy Page is massive. I do. I think Jimmy Page is massive because he was a great guitarist. He'd been playing guitar all his life. He started playing skiffle, which is like playing two chords over and over while someone else is playing two different chords harmoniously and whatnot. He was brilliant. He was really good. I play guitar. I'm not particularly great at it, but I play guitar. And when I watch him play guitar, I don't even know how he gets his hand in certain ways.
Mm.
I don't know how he plays certain things, even though I'm watching him do it.
Yeah.
It's just, it's out of this world. Because he did start the band initially when he came out the Yardbirds. It felt like they were very focused on what he was doing, mm-hmm. and the things he was into. Like later on when he got into like Aleister Crowley and stuff, and people thought that they were Satan worshippers, and it goes crazy. But I think he was just super good at what he did at the time, and with the new technology being like using electronics and stuff, he just blew people away.
And I think he kind of created this sort of metal mentality as well, that if you think of kind of other genres, what hooks you into a song is like the chorus. So it's like, yeah, you're really going for the chorus, or there might be a verse, which is really awesome or whatever. But with metal and hard rock, it's often the riff.
Yeah.
So Whole Lotta Love is a great example. Yeah, you're saying Whole Lotta Love, but if someone says to you, oh, do Whole Lotta Love, you almost do the riff yourself, don't
yeah.
you? Enter Sandman, Metallica, Sweet Child of Mine, Guns N' Roses, Cowboys from Hell, Pantera. They're all really good examples of it's the riff that you... Obviously, there's other elements of the song that you'll really enjoy, but what sucks you into that song in the first place is the riff. That's something that I think Jimmy Page kind of contributed, not just to the album, but to kind of hard rock and metal in general. I think that's kind of his thing.
I was just going to say, like, the riff, especially, like, as you say, in metal, that's like the hook in rap, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's that, you're right, it's the bit that you hold on to and remember. And he was just good at it. Like, the whole band were. I mean, they were all fantastic looking back.
A lot of the songs were written while they're on tour, and these kind of like sharp, sharp bursts in the studio. So it almost gives it this kind of like urgent feel to it. And I think that's a big part of the sound as well. And that's something that was obviously replicated for years to come.
Oh, yeah. And you've got producers. Like, the guy that did Nirvana's In Utero, he would, like, rock up at people's places, and he'd just have a couple of mics and his equipment and nothing else, and he'd just record it almost live, and he made some fantastic albums. I think it'll always be replicated, always. Yeah. It'll always be that seed somewhere. It'll always be a little part of them.
And it's that idea that, like I say, each song was almost recorded separately. It was recorded between all these different studios, between America and the UK. A lot of the riffs came from improvised sections from when Jimmy Page was playing Dazed and Confused live. So a lot of these fantastic riffs were things that he'd already come up with on stage or solos or whatever. Remembering them in his head and going, right, let's get in the studio, Do you think that that kind of raw on the spot approach is kind of missing in music today, with the idea that everything's auto-tuned and it's pitch perfect and has to be just right?
Yes and no. Like, you do have bands that are auto-tuned to bits and they don't play their own instruments and stuff like that. And then on the other side of the scale, you've got bands that come up with stuff like Muse. One of their newest songs, I think it's Drones, that was one of the kind of riffs they used to play as like an intermediate bit of their gigs, and it became a song. So I think that'll always be around as well. I just think now there's so many people trying to get into the business and it's so easy to get the software that people can auto-tune it and all that malarkey. And it's just very easy nowadays. I think there'll always be a part that's very raw, very hectic, and there'll always be a part that's very sedate and auto-tuned. And there's not a lot we can do about that, really.
I know that when we're talking about the kind of the raw on-the-spot approach against a polished studio product, it made me think a bit about Def Leppard. Ian and I, in the last episode, randomly got into this really interesting comparison of Radiohead and Def Leppard.
Right.
Which I wouldn't necessarily put the two together. Now, Def Leppard are heavily inspired by Led Zeppelin, and they've said so, but there is that degree of kind of a real polished studio product, especially like Hysteria. Now,
oh, yeah.
I love Hysteria. It's one of my favourite albums. But you certainly wouldn't say that it was a kind of raw on the spot kind of album. It's very polished, it's very produced.
Yeah, you can tell they took their time and that they did it all. But with Led Zeppelin, when they wanted to write an album, they would hire a place like a house or whatever, and they could record whenever they wanted, and they would literally spend like 2.5 hours to do a full song, whereas another band would spend 3 days.
And it made me laugh when you're talking about kind of a track taking 2.5 hours, that when I was then obviously thinking back about Hysteria by Def Leppard, that the track Animal, obviously not they weren't in the studio the whole time, but that track took nearly 3 years to record.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the two extremes right there. This album really, as we've discussed a little bit, marks the rise of Jimmy Page as a guitarist who would kind of be revered for decades to come. Like, and we've talked about the bands and the guitarists that he's influenced. But at the same time, it kind of marks Robert Plant's emergence as a great songwriter.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the tracks, and again, we'll go into this more and go track by track, I think Thank You is a really good example of that. Ramble On would be another.
Yeah.
On the first Led Zeppelin album, he wasn't 100% sure that he was going to be a permanent fixture in the band. This is kind of the moment when he's saying, this is my band, I'm part of Led Zeppelin, and where Jimmy Page has kind of got the confidence to say, well, yeah, actually, he's a great songwriter, let's run with this.
Yeah, well, they had asked other people to front the band before him, and one of them suggested Robert Plant, and that's how they got to him. He had a style of singing that, I don't know, he's a bit like a Freddie Mercury, where he's so different that I don't think you'll get anyone quite like him again.
Yeah.
Even if they try to replicate it, it just wouldn't be the same, I don't think.
When I think about the first time that I was listening to Led Zeppelin, and I mean, I love heavy metal, I love guitar, I think Jimmy Page is a fantastic guitarist, but what really struck me were the vocals. And I mean, A Whole Lot of Love was likely the first Led Zeppelin song I heard. I think Stairway to Heaven, obviously, you know, the standards. And I just remember thinking, this voice that he has is just something really unique, and it just, it fits so perfectly with the sound that they were creating.
Yeah, I mean, as heavy as they are, like when you say like Whole Lot of Love, when it, just as it goes into the kind of the slow on the hi-hat bit, and he's screaming love, and the way they like stretch it out,
yeah,
just that is fantastic in itself. I don't know if they knew how good they were or not, because they obviously knew they were good, because they were making more money than pretty much anyone. But some of the stuff they did was just ahead of its. They were like the Beatles. They were ahead of their time.
Yeah,
they were. They they were so switched on. They were like they were ahead of their time, ahead of the game, and that's why they were so big. That's why they were just different to everyone.
So we've touched on this a little bit, and no doubt, as we get into the individual songs, we'll kind of look into this in a bit more detail. But we've begun to discuss these accusations of plagiarism. And I think this is something that's hung over Led Zeppelin, a bit, pardon the pun, like a black dog through their career. I thought you'd like that. That, like, this idea that there's not much originality in some of the most iconic Led Zeppelin songs that are very much based on the blues. What's your knowledge on the subject, and does it impact on how you listen to the album?
I understand that, like, the plagiarism accusations, I just don't think it matters anymore now.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll affect their legacy ever. Mm-hmm. I think that they'll always be one of the greats, no matter what anyone says. Yeah.
And I think some of the tracks that there's been kind of issues of plagiarism around, the band have openly admitted that these were kind of homages or tributes to the people that they were supposed to be plagiarising. And it was more just an issue of that maybe they weren't properly credited for their contribution to that track. So yeah, now seems like a good time as any to go track by track. We've already discussed Whole Lotta Love in a lot of detail, but there's just so much to discuss with this song. So we could probably have had an hour's conversation about this song, really. So the riff, bassist John Paul Jones had said for a long time that it actually originated from one of these Dazed and Confused solos, as we were talking about earlier. But Jimmy Page says that's not true at all, and it is, in fact, that it was composed on his houseboat along the Thames. Radio 2 named it the greatest riff of all time in 2014 in the listeners' poll.
It's up there. It's definitely up there.
It's hard to argue with, isn't it?
It is, but I could never put a number one there. Not only am I a big music fan, I'm a big film fan. And people always say, well, what's your favourite film?
Mm-hmm.
And I could never point to a Blu-ray or DVD and say, that is the one.
Yeah.
It's like with bands, you've got top tier, like middle tier, lower tier. It'll always be like that. But Whole Lot of Love itself, that is definitely higher tier stuff, even if you just think of that one riff.
Yeah.
Because that one riff was like, when Top of the Pops was big, for example, that was the sound of music in the UK.
Yeah.
That's what people associated listening to music with.
I'm 30, and I remember that riff being used in Top of the Pops. There's so many people who probably heard that, like, what's that? And seeked it out and then discovered all this music, not just Led Zeppelin, but everything that kind of came after. But I think, and we talked about this a little bit when we talked about Robert Plant's vocal, that the middle section, this kind of like crazy free jazz hi-hat craziness in the middle, for me is almost as iconic as the riff itself.
Yeah, totally. Especially when they were live, they would keep that going for like 10 minutes in some songs. It's incredible how they could do that and then bring it all back together.
Yeah.
And complete the song and make it look effortless. But when Page is like using a violin bow and stuff like that, it's so crazy, but at the same time, it's so clever.
And I think what's interesting, we were talking a few minutes ago about this idea of, did they know how good they were and were things kind of planned meticulously, or did it just sort of happen? And what I'd read about this kind of section of the song is that Jimmy Page and Eddie Kramer, who was the audio engineer, were just experimenting on the sound console. So the song was essentially done. They were experimenting on the sound console, seeing what stuck. And this is what they came up with. And it's now this kind of like crazy, trippy, iconic moment in rock music. Not only that, but Robert Plant's vocal in that, it's actually a bleed through from a previous take. So they're doing all this. They can hear this coming through. They try to do something about it. And Jimmy Page goes, that sounds great. Just leave that on.
I never knew that about the bleed through. Yeah,
so that section generally didn't get played on the radio, because I guess in kind of 1970s Britain and America, that was just a bit too out there.
Led Zeppelin, they were a band that didn't like singles.
Yeah.
So that was one thing, and then the radios were always saying, well, it's too long, we need you to cut it down, and they wouldn't.
Yeah.
So the radio would have to try and make an edit where it came together, and I can't remember how they did it off the top of my head. I'd have to listen to it. But it's it is such a clever song because it's a rock song with just about everything.
Yeah, it absolutely.
Is, like you said, it's almost like an introduction to classic rock.
Mm.
It is.
And it's one of those that's always on these albums, like greatest rock classics of all time. And it's one of the songs that'll always make that. And a lot of that's just for the riff, but there is so much more to the song once you kind of listen to it. This is kind of the first instance on the album where we're talking about plagiarism. So to kind of go through this, because it's somewhat complex, Muddy Waters recorded a blues vocal called You Need Love in 1962. And that was written by a gentleman called Willie Dixon.
Yeah.
And in 1966, the Small Faces recorded the song as You Need Lovin' for their debut album. Now, Jimmy Page and Robert Plant went to quite a lot of Small Faces gigs and they really liked the song. Steve Marriott, who is the lead singer of the Small Faces, contends that the way that Robert Plant phrases and sings Whole Lot of Love is similar to the way that Steve Marriott sang You Need Lovin', even down to kind of inflections and where he stops and things like that. This led to a lawsuit in 1985 against Led Zeppelin, who settled out of court with Willie Dixon for an undisclosed amount. So that's kind of the first sort of example of that plagiarism, if you like. But when a song is kind of as iconic as this, they've not plagiarized the riff, for example. There's just something about this song that helps it transcend all that kind of messiness, if you like.
I think there is, because not a lot of people talk about any of the plagiarisms, especially not today. I'm surprised that that didn't get settled till the middle of the 80s, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it depends when they kind of brought that lawsuit to their attention or all sorts of things. But now Willie Dixon's name is included in the credits for Whole Lot of Love. So if you were to buy a remastered version of Led Zeppelin 2 or hear Whole Lot of Love on a compilation, his name would be there in the credits. There's a quote from Robert Plant from 1990 where basically somebody says that Page's riff was Page's riff and that was there before anything else. I just thought, well, what am I going to sing? That was it, and Nick, now happily paid for. At the time, there was a lot of conversation about what to do. It was decided that it was so far away in time and influence that, and then this is the bit that gets it for me, you only get caught when you're successful. That's the game. And I guess if Led Zeppelin had disappeared without a trace, we certainly wouldn't be having this conversation.
No.
And no one would probably even have known, to be honest.
No, that's the thing. And he's right in what he's saying. If they weren't like a hugely successful band, he wouldn't be suing them because he knows that he wouldn't be making anything from suing
them.
Mm-hmm. That's another thing. Like, money plays a factor in everything as well.
Yeah.
That's just how it is, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you alluded to this a little bit, that kind of when it was performed live, it would go on for a bit longer, that middle craziness would happen for longer, and it often incorporated other Led Zeppelin songs or blues classics in that interlude as well. It was actually the last song that the classic Led Zeppelin lineup played together live.
Oh, wow.
Which almost seems really fitting. Obviously, they've come back for reunions with Jason Bonham and that kind of thing, but that was the last song that the classic Led Zeppelin lineup played together.
I've got to say that when they've played with Jason Bonham, he is a fab drummer too.
Yeah.
He is really good.
Yeah. I saw him with Paul Rodgers. Paul Rodgers was doing a solo tour about five or 6 years ago, and Jason Bonham was on drums, and I was almost as excited to see him as I was to see Paul Rodgers. And he is phenomenal. He's an absolutely phenomenal drummer. Yeah. And I think he played with a band called Black Country Communion as well, who were definitely worth checking out. They're fantastic. So What Is and What Should Never Be is track two. Now, this is one of the first songs on which Jimmy Page would use his soon-to-become trademarked Gibson Les Paul for recording. So, obviously, they kind of go hand in hand. This is one of the first songs where we kind of saw that sort of partnership. This is one of the first songs as well recorded by the band that Robert Plant receives a writing credit for. Now, we've started to talk about his songwriting and kind of how important that becomes for the band and for Robert Plant in general. The lyrics actually reflect a romance that he had with his wife's younger sister. I don't know if you knew that.
I actually didn't, but that's actually a really cool thing to know, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, how does that song... Obviously, there's some really iconic songs on this album. We were talking earlier about how there's certain ones that really have stood the test of time and that there's others that maybe have faded away a little more for the casual listener. How do you feel about this particular track, and do you think it's a strong track?
I do, actually. I think it's a strong track. Really, there aren't many tracks on here that aren't strong tracks. Like, I've even heard Jimmy Page himself talk about this album, saying that, like, it got put down a bit because it didn't have a lot of hard rock songs on, like, the first one. And he was saying, but look, it's got great hits on.
Yeah.
And what they were pushing for when they weren't doing singles is they wanted their album to be a package. They wanted you to hear the whole thing, not just one part of them, which I think is a clever thing to do if people are willing to do it.
I think that it's something that is a bit that's kind of missing now sometimes, that we're in a kind of a moment now with things like streaming and downloads and that you can kind of pick and choose what you want to listen to.
Yeah.
And the idea of sitting down and listening to a whole album from start to finish, for some people, would be considered quite tiresome because they just want to hear the hits or they just want to hear the singles or whatever. I mean, obviously, in this case, there were no singles in the UK for this album. But it's that idea, and it's almost a very brave idea, that you listen to the album as a package and that there's almost, not necessarily a concept, but a theme that runs throughout it, be it musically, be it lyrically, whatever.
To me, that's a good thing. Like, some bands have pulled it off really well. Well, it's probably a while back now. The Streets, when they released their second album, probably about 10 years ago now. Christ, that makes me sound old. That album was really a package album because it had a theme going and a story going all the way through it.
Yeah.
And when you listen to it all, you realise what the story was and what was happening. And okay, they were a lot more subtle than that, maybe. But I don't think there's many songs on this album that you can kind of knock back and say it's not a superb song.
Absolutely. So this song, What Is and What Should Never Be, is coincidentally, just a bit of trivia for you at this point, has inspired the name of several TV episodes.
Yeah.
In America particularly. So, episodes of One Tree Hill, which is, for those who don't know, it's like an American teen drama from a few years back, Supernatural, and That 70s Show, all have episodes named after this song.
I didn't know The 70s Show did.
Yeah. You see, I'm making a confession here. So I used to love One Tree Hill, right?
Right.
I'm very much not the target audience, but I did. One Tree Hill trivia fact for you, that an episode of One Tree Hill in Series 3 had the distinction of being the first time that Led Zeppelin allowed their music to be used on a network television show in the US.
Oh,
so obviously Led Zeppelin have always been very famously not let their music be used for that kind of medium.
Yeah.
And the first time they allowed it to happen was in Series 3, One Tree Hill. And it was Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You. It was on the series finale.
See, it's clever in a way that they've kept their music like that because then you don't have people getting their hands on it and selling it, and then they sell it on and it ends up on everything.
There's something about mystique as well, isn't there, and
yeah.
integrity. So kind of if you're not really releasing singles and you're not really, obviously there's been very sporadic reunions since the band split and not using their music much on TV and film. Like with the Beatles, you hear Beatles songs all over the world all the time. With Queen songs, you hear Queen songs constantly. Now these are really huge bands, but in some ways that mystique and that aura is not there because their music's used so freely all the time. You hear We'll Rock You at every sporting event you can think of.
Yeah.
You know, I heard a Beatles song at the end of the Minions movie when I watched it recently. So there's always something. Whereas with Led Zeppelin, it's this mystique. It's this idea of, well, this music, it's almost, despite them being a huge band, it's almost like a hidden secret.
Kinda, yeah.
You've kind of got to look for it.
So I hope you're enjoying my chat so far with Andy Barkus about Led Zeppelin 2. We're going to continue to go through the album track by track, identifying some of the songs that have been accused of plagiarism over the years, plus which Led Zeppelin song is heavily inspired by the work of J.R.R. Tolkien. All of that to come right after this.
They'd never done anything like this album before, ever. There was such a mix of stuff on it.
Would you like to get involved with the discussion on My Classic Album, or maybe you'd like to be a guest on a future episode?
I don't think there's any other album that is so poignant and so human in its lyrics.
Like us on Facebook by searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris, Alternatively, you could follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or even tweet us over at MCA_podcast. And who knows, you could be chatting with me very soon about your classic album.
Now for me, it's the music that gets me with this one. It's just beautifully put together, in my opinion.
Make sure you never miss an episode and keep up to date with all the latest news at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk.
If you want to be in a future episode of My Classic Album, that is all the information you need. Episode 4's classic album and guest have both been confirmed, and at the end of this episode I'll let you know a little bit more about what to expect next month. But in the meantime, let's get back to my chat with Andy, and let's continue to go track by track with Led Zeppelin 2.
So, The Lemon Song is track 3. Which,
brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant song.
Awesome. Obviously, there's plenty of sexual innuendo in there.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of, I actually posted a meme, which makes me sound
I've
really...
I've just seen it.
Makes me seem really trendy. I'm really not. But I posted a meme as soon as I was announcing what album it was going to be, because it just made me chuckle, which obviously had lyrics from The Lemon Song. Check out the Facebook page if you want to see that one. This one was recorded virtually live in the studio while they were on tour. And the echo on Robert Plant's voice, there's no kind of studio trickery going on. That's just the acoustics of the studio.
Oh, right.
So they're in a 16-foot by 16-foot room with wooden walls, recording The Lemon Song with all these crazy lyrics about this, that and the other. And that's how they got that really cool acoustic sound.
See, like, it's funny because although we're doing this podcast about this particular album, I've got to admit, I don't know everything about this album.
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
What's cool is I'm learning stuff too. I love it.
Yeah, and I think that's what's cool about it, that just because you like an album doesn't necessarily mean that you have like all this knowledge about it. You know, I said this, I think, in episode one, you don't listen to an album because you know everything about it. You listen to an album because you love it. You don't love it because you know that Robert Plant recorded that vocal in a 16-foot by 16-foot room with wooden walls. That's not why you like The Lemon Song.
Yeah.
It's just a cool little fact that you learn along the way. This is another one that's kind of victim to this kind of plagiarism tag. So we're talking about Howlin' Wolf now, who had a track called Killin' Floor. Now, Led Zeppelin used to cover this one on their live shows during their first tour of the States. And this song kind of evolved on stage during their other tours into The Lemon Song.
Yeah.
And Robert Plant would improvise the lyrics on stage. Now, the lyrics between the opening lyrics between the two songs are actually identical.
Yeah.
They have said that the Lemon Song is kind of like a tribute to Howlin' Wolf. And I guess that's the question. And I know what you're going to say, because again, we kind of covered this earlier. Do you think it's plagiarism, or is it simply a tribute to the blues and Howlin' Wolf?
A bit of both. I mean, this is still early on in their career. Mm. So I think you take from what you know.
Yeah.
And like, because they've been doing bits while they're live, they know the song, they obviously know who wrote it and mm-hmm. all that, and although they have done their own version, I still don't think it does anything to diminish the song, because it's a brilliant, a really good song.
And I think that's the thing, and we were discussing this before, and it's kind of, it's the debate if you are discussing Led Zeppelin and plagiarism, that some people can't get past that fact. This is blatantly Howlin' Wolf's song, or it's somewhat close to an approximation as to what it was. I'm not going to give it a chance now.
I get that, I do, but, like, say, in their whole career, they've got, like, say, 6 songs that people say are plagiarised. Think of all the other songs mm-hmm. they've wrote, and with the plagiarism, all they've done is try to enhance a previously released song or interpret a song.
I think for me, what's interesting is that this idea of recording, and I know it's not pop music, but popular music's probably a better term, that was still quite a new thing, really. If you think of the turn of the century, it was still very much classic music. It wasn't really until we get into kind of the 50s and the 60s that this idea of albums and touring and all this was a thing. They're kind of entering a brave new world at this point, where people are starting to kind of say, well, hang on, that's mine, and this, that, and the other. And it's kind of something that artists wouldn't dream of doing that now, simply because if I recorded my own version of The Lemon Song and released it as my own without crediting Led Zeppelin, their lawyers will be on the phone to me within 24 hours because just kind of the way that the world works now. But back then, perhaps, you know, we were all kind of learning the nature of what the music business was going to be like. And, you know, there was never any argument from Led Zeppelin. What happened? They settled out of court with Howlin' Wolf, and he received royalties and a songwriting credit as a result of that.
If you're thinking of writing something and there's a gap and you can't fill it, you'll go back to what you know, which is the blues. And that's why I think that they get away with it.
Yeah.
Because we know that these songs were plagiarised slightly, or some parts of them were, but no one really complains about it no more. They just say it how it was.
Yeah. And I think the fact is that all of these songs we're talking about, obviously, there was an issue where someone felt they'd been plagiarised. The band settled out of court. They've got songwriting credits. So in that sense, no one is really going to bring that up much anymore. It's more going to be people who are detractors of the band who think that it's at the expense of being creative or that sort of thing. To which I would tend to disagree. I think there's a lot of creativity on this album. Obviously, we're talking about the blues and the folk influences and the growth and this kind of hard rock blueprint that would be kind of around for decades to come, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, these guys, they did, like, the Beatles set a standard, and then these set another standard.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference was, like, when you went to see the Beatles back then, you went to see the Beatles, not to listen to the music.
Mm.
Whereas with Led Zeppelin, you went to listen to the music because it was amazing.
I work with someone who actually went to see the Beatles in Wolverhampton in 1963. And I'd said, wow, the Beatles. You went to see the Beatles. What were they like? He said, I didn't hear a bloody thing. Because there were just all these screaming girls and the craziness.
That's it, yeah. Or
the idea that even at Shea Stadium, when they were playing these massive shows, that they couldn't even hear each other because it was just so loud. Whereas with Led Zeppelin, you're saying it was much more, you were going to hear the music, to hear the kind of the technique and the fantastic musical and vocal ability of this phenomenal band.
I think you were, and like especially in the early to mid 60s when you start getting kind of psychedelic drugs coming along. I know no one wants to hear about drugs, but back then, like, it was a big thing amongst bands, probably still is, and we don't know about it. But back then, it kind of was, and I think that played into it as well. Like, they got a lot of people who were just into the music because they were on psychedelics or whatever, and they just dug it. They thought, like, when it went deep and stuff, they were just, I don't know, like, but yeah, it was a funny period. It was a funny period in Britain.
So the next song, you said, there were six songs that Led Zeppelin had been accused of plagiarising.
Yeah.
There's all this other great material that doesn't get kind of thought of. And I think the next song's a very underrated song. It's possibly my favourite on the album. Thank You.
Yeah, very underrated. That was one of the songs, like I mentioned earlier, that they said they thought was underrated on the album. And I would tend to agree with them.
Yeah.
I think because, especially nowadays, people will grab this album just for, say, the four, like, big hits on it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll potentially miss this or just listen to, like, the beginning of it or something. And they should really listen to the full song.
Absolutely. And I think when we're talking about this kind of being a blueprint for metal and hard rock and stuff, Thank You, I don't think particularly falls into that category. But it's just a beautiful song.
Yeah, that's it. You could be like a massive heavy metal band and still make a song that, like, gets someone's emotions going. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Thank You does that. It is like a beautiful little song.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought of it like that. This idea, I'm saying it's not a blueprint for metal and hard rock, but it gave these bands permission to do a quieter song or a more mellow song or whatever. Because obviously Black Sabbath had songs like Changes, Metallica had songs like Nothing Else Matters, you know, songs that aren't heavy and riff-tastic, but still have a place on an album. I think Thank You is a really good example of that.
Yeah, it is. That's one of the early, like, Nothing Else Matters songs. Yeah. You got that good there. Like,
it was a tribute to Robert Plant's wife, Maureen, and he's credited, it's the first Led Zeppelin song, in fact, where he's credited solely for the lyrics. Now, as I talked about earlier, this is kind of the song where Jimmy Page realised, he was thinking, well, actually, you know, this has kind of been my baby for a while now, but I can kind of hand the reins over to him kind of lyrically now. And it's just, I can't kind of say enough what a great track that I think it is. There is a degree of bias for me in that Robert Plant famously sang Thank You as an intro to a crazy little thing called Love at the Freddie Mercury tribute concert.
Right.
So obviously they had all the different artists coming on through the day to sing Queen songs. Robert Plant came on. He sang Thank You, and it segued straight into Crazy Little Thing Called Love, and it was just a cool little moment.
It was a really good show, that, actually. Yeah. I thought Annie Lennox was brilliant in that show, and what happened to Annie Lennox?
Yeah, I mean,
she was fab.
Yeah,
she was fab.
I would love to do an Annie Lennox or a Eurythmics album at some point, if anyone wants to. That'd be cool. When you watch the tribute concert, it's one of those big moments, like George Michael singing Somebody I Love's another kind of highlight. What often gets hidden away is the fact that Robert Plant sang Innuendo with Queen. It didn't actually make any kind of subsequent like DVD releases or anything, because Robert Plant didn't like it. He didn't think he'd done the song justice. But I could argue that a track like Innuendo can take a lot from Led Zeppelin. I think that, and we'll talk about this a little more with a song later on, I think that early Queen takes a lot of kind of influence from Led Zeppelin too, but we'll kind of get into that. There's a particular track that I was going to talk about that with, so we'll move on for now. So Heartbreaker is our next track, and essentially with Heartbreaker, as great as the song as it is, really what we're talking about is the solo.
Yeah.
That's really, because it's essentially, there is the blueprint of the kind of guitar solo for years and years and years to come. It was actually recorded as an afterthought, so the song was ready, and Jimmy Page thought, let's throw a solo in there. And he made this kind of crazy, frantic, erratic solo that kind of makes me think of loads of other guitarists that have obviously heard that and thought, my God, I want to pick up a guitar. Did it have much of an effect on you, being that you play guitar? Were you playing guitar before that, or did it change your style of playing or anything like that?
I was playing guitar probably before I started listening to Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Like, I was listening to Nirvana and things like that. Even then, I didn't realise how big, for instance, Nirvana were. Do you know what I mean? Because I was still young. But then, like, I injured my hand not long after, and I wasn't able to play guitar for a while. But then, when I started listening to more bands and stuff, it is solos like that, I'm not saying that particular solo.
No.
But solos like that and other guitarists I've seen made me buy new gear and start playing again, because there's some stuff you see and it does make, if you can play a guitar, it does make you want to pick your guitar up. Like, for instance, now I permanently have a semi-acoustic guitar beside my couch. So if music comes on the TV and I like it, I can either learn it or I can play along. Or
yeah.
It's weird, but it's something I like to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
That song will have inspired a lot of people, especially in like the heavy metal genre, to put these kind of big, long solos into their music, which I think it's a fine thing. I love solos, I do. I wish I could play them better, because I'm a rhythm guitarist, not a solo guy. But it's just amazing. Like, I don't know if it's the hand injury I had or what, but I just can't solo at all. I can play a few Jimi Hendrix songs and that's it. If I could solo like that,
I'd
be in a band for sure.
So when you're talking about kind of these heavy metal guitarists and hard rock guitarists being inspired, particularly by this solo, I instantly, when I listened to it, with the benefit of hindsight, I instantly think of Eruption by Van Halen. It's just totally, like, you can tell that he's obviously studied the way that Jimmy Page plays. Obviously, Van Halen, Eddie Van Halen, has that style all of his own. But even he would admit that he's heavily influenced by the work of Jimmy Page. And Heartbreak is a really good example of the kind of solo we're talking about.
I've never actually thought about it like that before. And that does sound like he's listened to that totally. Yeah.
And then, I mean, Steve Vai is also, I mean, we talked about him a little earlier. He's highlighted this solo as having a huge impact on him and how he plays guitar. You know, it's great in the modern day when you have these guitarists who are citing people like Jimmy Page and Brian May and Slash as these kind of epic guitarists. But it's so cool to hear what other guitarists, who they look up to, kind of the classic era, people like Van Halen and Steve Vai. I think it's pretty cool to hear their inspiration and their influences. So the next track on the album, Living Loving Maid, She's Just a Woman. Now, this was actually the B-side to A Whole Lot of Love when that was released in America. Now, we were talking about how Jimmy Page feels that this is like an underappreciated album. He's actually gone on record as saying that this is one of his least favourite Led Zeppelin songs.
I never knew that.
Yeah, about a groupie who stalked the band early on in their career.
That must be a horrible situation, and it's one of the reasons I don't like playing guitar in front of people even.
Mm.
I would hate it if I was in a band and someone just started following you around.
Yeah.
And I would probably end up writing a song about it.
It is kind of crazy how kind of fixated people can get, and I certainly don't think that's unique to rock music. I think that's just kind of almost like a human trait that we have for kind of the idea of celebrity.
Like, everyone's kind of got a hero in mind, haven't they? Or everyone aspires to be like X or Y. It's a funny thing, but we're humans. What can we do?
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting that that's like a song that they've a topic that they've chosen to write about.
Yeah.
But as I say, Jimmy Page doesn't particularly rate the song. Having said that, it gets a lot of radio play, particularly in America, because it's often played together with Heartbreaker, because the song topics are kind of similar, and because they kind of run together on the album, it kind of flows really well. So they do often get played together on radio.
It's an alright song. It's not one of my favourites on the album, I've got to be honest, but it's still a totally solid song.
Mm. Ramble On is the next track on the album.
Ramble On is superb.
It really is.
That's probably one of my favourite songs by them, to be honest.
Yeah, like, period, not even just the album, just kind of full stop.
I don't even know why. Mm. I couldn't tell you why.
It's lyrically inspired by the work of J.R.R. Tolkien. There's actually references to, like, Mordor and Gollum and that in the lyrics. Robert Plant was obviously heavily inspired. I don't know if he was reading that stuff at the time or whether he's a general fan of Tolkien, but that was a big part of kind of this world, well, not even that he created really, that Tolkien created, that he used for the song. And it importantly for me, what I thought, it establishes a relationship between hard rock and metal and the idea of fantasy.
Yeah,
we're in the genesis of kind of hard rock and heavy metal. This is very much the beginning of that. So you think of Freddie Mercury's songwriting on the early Queen albums, so you're thinking 70s Awry, Lily of the Valley, March of the Black Queen. They were all set in this kind of world that him and his sister had created called Rye. The idea that he would then use that in his music has to have come somewhat from the idea that Robert Plant did that just a couple of years before.
Quite possibly,
Ronnie James Dio is another musician who's incorporated a lot of fantasy.
Yeah.
More recently, you talk about like Coheed and Cambria. You know, Coheed and Cambria have got all like albums and albums set in this kind of universe that they've created. As I've said about Freddie, you could argue that that all kind of comes back to Ramble On, and it makes it such an important song for the genre, in that it gave people permission to go, right, let's go into our heads, let's create these crazy worlds. And fair enough, this was kind of Tolkien's world, but it gave Led Zeppelin permission as well to think, right, well, what do we want to explore beyond kind of sex and the blues and all these other things?
I think it shows that they were at a time where they were exploring. They weren't just thinking that we need to have sex or we need to do as much blow as we can.
Yeah.
It was like, we need to expand a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the mystery comes from.
Because
people, obviously, you don't get to see what they're doing in their everyday lives and what they're learning about. and you only hear little bits through their songs, but like as you say, they were obviously reading like Tolkien and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, it adds to the mystery, the intrigue. It makes people think about where they're getting the lyrics from.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, it's just one of the best songs on the album for me.
Yeah.
Easy.
Or any album in some ways, yeah. When you think of it, kind of its significance.
It is so good.
Yeah.
To me, anyway, that's just personal preference. Yeah. So.
And I think as well, obviously, we're talking lyrically about how it sounds. That's one that kind of has a bit of a folky edge to it as well.
Yeah,
and kind of the way that the whole band almost changed their approach to their instrument in that song. And that, you know, you've got this kind of really soft drum sound from John Bonham and really tight kind of connection with John Paul Jones. And then Jimmy Page doing, the, you know, these kind of indescribable sounds at times just to create this really, really kind of, as we said, a mysterious, awe-inspiring kind of sound
that
kind of fits in with the lyrical content just perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, it's mysterious, it's intriguing, but it's also very mellow.
Mm-hmm.
It's, when you're listening to it, you're not thinking, like, something bad's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's almost sucking you in type thing. It's really clever, I think.
Yeah, it's another song that was slightly later than this. It was on Black Sabbath's Paranoid album. And I always think that Planet Caravan has that kind of effect as well, if you've ever heard that song. And I mean, that one's actually set in space. It's the idea of floating through space and all this sort of thing. But it's just mellow. Everybody's kind of scaled it back a bit. They're doing something a bit different. It just puts you in a different headspace. And I think that, you know, it's another good example of exploring something beyond earthly concepts and themes. Yeah.
It's bands like this, I think when you listen to them, they kind of make you think slightly deeper about things.
So Moby Dick is the next track. I think if you were talking about drum solos in general, when you go to a live concert, a lot of people, I've heard the joke before, drum solo, toilet break. The idea that it's like, the drummer's got 5 minutes, let's go get a drink at the bar, let's go to the toilet, whatever. But we're not just talking about kind of any drummer at this point, we're talking about John Bonham. So Moby Dick was obviously named after the whale in the book, and known previously as Pat's Delight or Over the Top. And they're saying that this Moby Dick drum solo would become the basis or form part of John Bonham's drum solos and concept. I listened to it and I wasn't thinking, oh, here we go, drum solo. I was enjoying it for what it was. I was enjoying the fact that I'm listening to a master at work. The main question for me, I guess, is would we call John Bonham the greatest drummer of all time? And is this kind of evidence of that?
I'd say he's one of the best. I wouldn't say the best, but I would say he's one of the best. He's in the top five, but I couldn't put them in order.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Is there anyone else that you'd kind of throw in with John Bonham just to get an idea of kind of the company that
I don't know. Like someone like Cozy Powell.
Yeah.
He's a magnificent drummer, do you know what I mean? And it's almost the same era. In fact, when John Bonham unfortunately died, Cozy Powell could have took that space quite. He could have done a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they were so tight that they knew that if one of them left, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, that was it.
It's a bit like lightning in a bottle. And I mean, we've talked about the Beatles and Queen. I think that these three bands are really good examples of when you've got something that just works between four people. The Beatles had long split, but the moment that John Lennon was sadly killed, there was no hope of a Beatles reunion of any kind of scale. Obviously, Queen have toured with Paul Rogers and Adam Lambert since, but that's only been Brian May and Roger Taylor. It's not been the same since there were the four of them in the 70s and the 80s doing what they do best. So there's something kind of about that collective unit and having four people where everything just works and fires on all cylinders, and it's not going to be quite the same even if you did put a Cozy Powell in there or you put anyone else in there.
It's, I don't know, it's like when you see some people and, like, they've got all the gear but no idea, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you'll get a drummer and they'll have loads of different hats and toms and etc. But they'll only know, like, how to do 4-4 or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you've got someone like Bonham, who he's got like the bloody big cymbal behind him and the gong thing behind him. And you think he's never going to use that, but he does. He uses everything he's got.
Yeah.
he was an amazing drummer, and I'd definitely say he's won the top five ever.
Yeah.
Won the top five. I don't want to say it's just like a drum solo, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess that's it. It's the danger of saying, because it is a lot more than that. Obviously, the beginning and the end is more than just drums.
Yeah.
And it's almost a disservice to it to just say, like, oh, it's a drum solo.
Yeah, I don't want to say, oh, it's just a drum solo, because then there might be people that think, oh, so it's just like an interlude.
That's a really good point, because it's almost that idea of like, oh, well, this is, you know, because you do have albums with little interludes in, yeah, little musical bits, and it's not that it is very much a track of its own and it stands as strong as everything else on the album.
That's
just
it.
In the way that Jimmy Page's guitar solo holds really strong in Heartbreaker. I guess the question, we're talking about how great a drummer he's been, you're saying top five possibly of all time, surely every rock and metal drummer, surely there's a part of them that wants to be John Bonham.
Yes, I think so. I think every drummer wants to have a bit of Keith Moon and John Bonham in them.
Yeah.
Because they are they're top of the game drummers, and like with people like Posey Powell and that.
The art of the great drummer is something that's kind of been lost in recent years. Obviously, Dave Grohl's a really good example.
Oh yeah.
You know, but then Dave Grohl with Foo Fighters, he's up front, he's on guitar, but obviously he was always a drummer primarily. John Fred Young, who drums for Blackstone Cherry, is a fantastic drum player. But again, it's the idea of having your drummer kind of take center stage for a while. That's something that doesn't happen so much.
No.
They're very much kind of the bass and the drums are very much the backbone of the band, as they always have been.
Yeah.
But it's sometimes at the expense of, you know, the singer or the guitarist who's noodling away doing some crazy solo.
I don't think the drummer is just how some people perceive them as like the dumbest one in the band. I mean, maybe in some bands.
Yeah.
There's got to be some bands where he's not the smartest one there. Mm. But it's not like they meant to test for this sort of thing, is it? So, to me, I like to think of it as a full song and not just like an interlude or a drum solo or anything like that.
Absolutely. So we're now on to the last track of the album.
Yeah.
Aptly titled Bring It On Home.
Yeah.
So, again, we'll not go too much into the plagiarism. I think we've talked that to death to some extent, but this is another one. But in this sense, it was a deliberate homage. The intro and the outro were actually in tribute to the Sonny Boy Williamson song of the same name. And again, it was another Willie Dixon song, and they settled that out of court. But in this sense, it was very much a tribute this time. How do you feel that it ends the album? Do you feel it's a strong track to end on? Is there a track that you would rather put there, or...?
I think it's an alright song to finish an album on, for sure. Is it the strongest song on the album? No. Is it the worst song on the album? No. It's just a solid song. As to finishing the album on it, well, you could, in theory, finish the album on a couple of songs on there. But I honestly don't know how to go around picking like where I would put the songs.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I guess it's a difficult thing. I know that when we were talking about OK Computer, obviously Airbag opens that album, and there was a track in the middle of the album that was almost the opener, but they felt that was perhaps too hard-hitting and cynical to kind of open it. Mm-hmm. So it must be quite a balancing act, really, to think, well, I think this song will go really well at the end, or to open. I mean, when you're grabbing people's attention, you know, A Whole Lot of Love's up. Perfect album opener in that sense, to kind of think, well, what order is this going to be? How's this going to work, and is it going to flow well? And I guess what you're saying is that you think that the whole album just flows really well, and
pretty much, yeah. And like they will have sat down and thought about it, because like we were talking about, they didn't like selling it unless it was a package.
Mm.
So where the track's placed for them, I think, will have been an important decision. Do you know what I mean? It'll have been a hard decision, because then you've got songs that don't make it onto the album and end up on EPs and stuff. I think by this stage in their career, this is when they were refining everything they had, and they were ready to expand and blow up. And the album as a whole, I think if you listen to them all, you can tell this is the one where they were like, right, we have something here.
Yeah.
We can take this to the next plateau.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
And it's that idea, as we've been saying, that Jimmy Page is really coming into his own. Rubber Plant is as a songwriter. Yeah. The band's just really tight. They've got, obviously, the beginnings of what would become known as hard rock and heavy metal. There's folk, there's blues. It all just kind of comes together to create a really, a great album, but an interesting album at the same time. There's so much going on. I mean, the album's 46 years old. How do you think, in that sense, bearing in mind everything we've discussed, how do you think it stands the test of time?
I think it's done amazing. I do think this album has stood the test of time. On the whole, I think Led Zeppelin will always stand the test of time.
Yeah.
They're just too big not to. I don't think it matters which album you pick either. I think they're just too big not to be able to bring them to the table and discuss.
So finally, this is the last question that I've asked everybody so far. So if someone was to fast forward to the end of the podcast, they didn't want to hear us ramble on for an hour or so. Why do you think that Led Zeppelin 2 is your classic album? And why would you recommend that people buy it?
Personally, I would recommend this album because of the fact that it's not full of hits. It does have a couple of hits on there, and it does have a Whole Lot of Love, which everyone knows. But it's not hit-laden. It's got some more drawn-back music on. It's got a little bit of folky stuff on. And it has a bit of an aura around it. And I don't think a lot of people have heard a lot of these songs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if they were to listen to the album as a whole, how they wanted you to listen to it, you'd have a lot more respect for the album than just saying, oh, it was their second album and it had a Whole Lot of Love on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That's why, for me, it's one of the better Led Zeppelin albums, because it makes you want to listen to the rest of them.
Mm.
That's kind of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and I think that works, because, you know, if you're getting into a band and you listen to an album you don't like, it, you're not going to go any further. But Led Zeppelin 2 is a really good starting point, not just for the band, but to kind of take you into that kind of hard rock metal thing, if that's what you're interested in, if you want to discover these bands, this is kind of where it all began.
Yeah, and like that one album, you can go off in a couple of directions. You don't just have to go heavy rock.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? You can go mellow, or you can go with effects and solos, and there's a lot of possibilities just from that one album. And I've got to be honest, I love it.
Yeah.
I do. This is one of my In The Car albums. It is. It's really good.
Awesome. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah. And brilliant. Thank you very much.
Super. Have a good day.
Once again, I'd like to thank Andy Barkas very much for taking time out to come and talk to me about Led Zeppelin 2. It really is an influential album. It's a fantastic album, and not just because of Whole Lot of Love. There's so much going on that album, and if you've not listened to it before, I hope that this episode has made you kind of turn an eye towards it and have a listen to an album that truly marked the birth of heavy metal and rock in the UK and all over the world. Now, this might mark the end of October's edition of My Classic Album, but don't forget that I'll be back next month and hopefully for a few months to come discussing other great classic albums. And November's guest and album, as I said earlier, is already in the can. I'm going to be speaking with a very talented blues rock singer, Reed Turchie, about Randy Newman's classic 1974 album, Good Old Boys. Now, while the album hasn't reached the commercial successes of, say, a Revolver or a Led Zeppelin 2, it's still very much a classic album. And if your knowledge of Randy Newman ends with film scores and films like Toy Story and Monsters, Inc., I think that you'll be very surprised and enlightened by the album that he produced. Either way, I think that I'm brazen enough to say that next month's edition of My Classic Album is simply can't miss. The conversation I had with Reed was so interesting and touched on so many different points beyond the scope of music and the album. So I thoroughly recommend that you join us next month for my conversation with Reed Turchie about Randy Newman's Good Old Boys. Until then, I've been Mike Norris, and I'll see you next month.